Welcome to the sixth episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. I am a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Since my last podcast, I've done a long course triathlon in Claremont, Florida. This is the old style 1.2-mile swim, 40-mile bike ride, and 9-mile run. I actually managed to win my age group, which is somewhat of a hoot. Swimming is my weakest event. I was also swimming in a lake in Florida, which you often think of gators when you think of a lake in Florida. I tried to console myself thinking that if I just stayed in the pack, I would be just really unlucky if a gator got me. Apparently, they take motorboats out in the morning and kind of flush the gators or kind of scare them away a little bit. It was kind of brought back to my attention when we were standing around waiting for the award ceremony and in the pond just right across the parking lot from the lake that we swam in was a gator just floating around. So that was a little eerie, and I must admit I had a little bit of a nightmare that night. Anyway, after the swim was over, I got on the bike, and I usually, because I'm a slower swimmer, have to catch the girls on the bike, and I wasn't seeing any girls, so I thought, geez, I must be really far behind. So it wasn't really to the end of the race where I realized that I was actually in the front, so I didn't catch or I didn't see anybody in my age group. So that was kind of a nice surprise. I've also completed a bike ride called the Sugarloaf 8. It's sponsored by Epic Cycle House in Claremont. It's an 88-mile ride that's 8 times up one of the steepest hills in Claremont called Sugarloaf. There's about 6,300 feet of climbing for the total ride, which is a lot for a Florida ride. Interestingly enough, we tried using roasted potatoes as a nutrition source for this ride that worked really well. They tasted really good after you got tired of some sports drink. We also used a bar that was listed in VegSource.com by Juliana Hever, who wrote Vegan for Idiots book. This was an oatmeal chocolate chip cookie, which I kind of made into bars, and we used that too. So that worked out really good, and it was kind of nice to have a low-oil, plant-based source of nutrition that wasn't just plain sugar. So it's nearly the end of October, which has been, as most of you know, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I can only wish it wasn't Breast Cancer Prevention Month. I think that if we could promote eliminating animal protein and dairy, the risk of breast cancer would markedly be reduced, as well as the recurrence of breast cancer in people already diagnosed. I'd also like to recommend a tablespoon and a half of flaxseed ground. You can add it to a smoothie or to the oatmeal in the morning. It really decreases your risk by providing a ligand that is very protective. That along with a low oil, plant-based diet and maintaining a healthy lean weight, you can really cut your risk of developing breast cancer as well as colon cancer. It really bothers me to see advertisements for milk and yogurt with the pink caps on top, because that really is a contributor to the problem. And you can throw all the money you want at early diagnosis, but once the cancer's there, it's there, and we'd be much better off putting our money in educating people on the basis of a plant-based diet as a means of prevention, as instead of trying to figure out how to treat breast cancer once it becomes rampant. Today's guest is Professor Gordon Harvey. He is a department chair at Jacksonville State University in Alabama. I started listening to Gordon's podcast, Running to Disney, when I was training for a marathon. At that time, he was about 260 pounds. He was trying to run his first marathon and take his family to dinner to Disney to celebrate and run the Disney Marathon. It chronicled his struggles training to run a marathon while being at that weight. Subsequently, he changed his nutrition and gradually evolved to become plant-based. He's since run over 10 marathons, a 70.3 triathlon, as well as numerous ultra marathons, and now weighs 159 pounds. He also lives in a mixed household. His wife and kids still are not completely plant-based, although they are transitioning. He also lives in a rural location, which makes finding a wide variety of vegan transition-type foods a little bit more cumbersome. He talked about buying, you know, a lot of his produce in Walmart locally, which, you know, now has actually evolved to have a lot of organic produce. So I think you'll find the interview quite interesting. He has a struggle just like every other American is trying to regain their health. He's a very dedicated father of two sons and a dedicated husband, and he really did a great effort in transitioning to a plant-based diet and changing his life so that he could take care of his family. I think you'll find his story very inspiring, as I have, and you know, I hope to keep in touch with him over the years because I think he's a great inspiration to everyone. It's my pleasure today to have Gordon Harvey with me. First, Gordon, I would like to thank you for changing my cardiology practice. I was plant-based before. I saw you coming, you know, a little bit on and off, or listened to your podcast on and off. But when I heard you and Megan discussing Forks Over Knives, and I actually watched that DVD, I was like, there's no way that I can't be plant-based, and there's no way that my practice can't be plant-based. So I thank you.
That's cool. Well, that's cool. Wow, that's my pleasure. You never know when this stuff's going to kind of click, or you know, you never know who might take it and benefit from it. So that's awesome.
I followed, you know, I started listening probably pretty to your podcast, Running to Disney, probably pretty early into it because, you know, I was out doing a marathon training run when you had the episode where you crossed the finish line, and I'm pretty sure there wasn't a dry eye listening to you when you crossed. So.
Well, I remember every now and then I'd put something on Twitter or you'd respond to the show or something on Twitter. I remember that vividly now. It's, for some reason, I remember now it was something we were talking about stretching or something. And we kind of had a mini debate over stretching or something or ab work. No, it was ab work, I think. I can't remember now, but I just remember that now.
So. It's probably some sort of core routine because I'm prone to pulling my back out of place. And people would say it's all kinds of hip injuries. And, you know, it turns out it actually ended up being some sort of nerve injury. And when I would fix my core, then that would kind of alleviate that. And I've heard so many people over the years, you know, talking about these hip injuries and even having hip surgeries when the reality was it actually was nerves in their back that was just getting tweaked by pounding.
Yeah, right. I think that's what it was. That really started to come back now.
Yeah. Just to, you know, my listeners aren't going to know anything about this story, but basically you're a professor in Alabama of history, and you were a standard American diet kind of guy living in Alabama, eating the Alabama way, overweight, and decided to change your life and run a marathon and take your kids to Disney. Tell me a little bit about that first, why you got started and how things went.
Yeah, well, it was, I remember, well, I guess you remember Brushes with Death, you know, vividly, but it was, it was December of 06. And, we had started going to Disney every year with the kids, a year before that. So we were, it was Christmas, almost Christmas break for the kids. And we were going to go to Disney that right after Christmas Day. And they got the flu, about a week before we left. And we were, you know, thinking, oh man, you know, all the money lost. And we got them healthy, and you know, my wife and I bathed ourselves in Purell and, you know, washed our hands 50 million times a day to make sure we didn't get it, because we figured that, you know, if they get it 1 week, we get it the next, we're not going to Disney, there's money lost. And so one Saturday morning I woke up with a fever and, you know, what I thought were the burning flu eyes, and so I ran to the Saturday clinic and wanted to get some sort of medicine or something, you know. Come to figure out it really wasn't the flu. It was the fact that I had really, really high blood pressure. It was 166 over 116. I remember those numbers. And they made me lay down in a dark room and take some medicine. And then they were going to send me to the emergency room until a friend of mine who was a physician said, no, I'll take care of you. We'll get you some medicine. I'll get you on meds and you'll be fine. And that scared me literally almost to death. So, and that's when I decided I had to start living right and lose weight. And because it was largely, I mean, I'd always been told, you know, this is hereditary. Your parents have high blood pressure. You're going to get high blood pressure. It's nothing but hereditary. And I just bought into that and just kept eating, you know. But, you know, I lost weight and I was able to dial back the meds a little bit. And I just decided I needed to start running. That was the quickest way to lose weight. And so I started running and decided that I needed some big goals. It took a while for me to realize I wanted to run a marathon because I told my brother-in-law one time that I'm just going to do 5Ks. I'm a 5K guy. You know, marathons are for nuts. And I just fell in love with running. And I got to the point where, I think I remember, you know, that was the whole reason I started the podcast, was that we were at Disney one January during marathon weekend, and we were spectators and people running through Epcot. Finishing the marathon, I was like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. People that don't know these people are clapping and cheering, and those people look dead, but they look so fulfilled, and I want to do that. So I did.
That's fantastic. And, you know, as I remember, you know, you finished the marathon, and you were exhausted but elated, and like everybody else, maybe I could do this a little faster. And so we'll try something again. And, you know, you caught the bug. And I remember you speaking with Megan, who was vegan, and she mm-hmm. would gently say some things about plant-based. And you yep. tried to change your diet a little bit, but still were hanging on to, I'm from Alabama. I like my burgers. I like my fried chicken. You know, this is the way it's got to be.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, when I was training for the first marathon, and, you know, I started this in Louisiana, and I got a new job and moved here to Alabama in the middle of it. And a friend of mine from Louisiana, I was on the phone with him when I was training for the marathon. He goes, oh, I bet you're so skinny now. I bet you're running so many miles. I bet you've lost so much weight. And I was like, actually, I think I've gained weight because, you know, you get back from a long run and you eat a bunch of chicken wings or cheeseburgers. And, you know, after that first marathon, I really wasn't trying to lose weight up to that first marathon. I had lost some weight, but I was still on meds, right? I'm still over 200 pounds. And, you know, after that first marathon, I ate double cheeseburgers and fries for the rest of our trip to Disney. I mean, it was just like, I run a marathon. I'm going to, you know, quadruple these calories back. So yeah, I had to learn that, you know, just because you're running doesn't mean you're automatically going to lose the weight. And that's one of the big myths about just running alone. So I had to dial in my nutrition and count calories was the only way to do it. That's the only way I've ever lost weight is, you know, burning more than I eat. And so I found, that, you know, the less cheese and meat, high calorie items I ate, and the more vegetables and fruits, which were low calorie high density items that I ate, I felt fuller, but I also was eating fewer calories. And guess what? The weight came off, you know, so it was about, you know, it was one of those, you know, knock yourself in the head, aha moments that it's a simple formula. You just had to stick with it and find it. And it worked out well. I, you know, ended up losing after that marathon, another, 70 pounds, I think. So.
Yeah, I remember hearing you because, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you were that much of a cook before this all started, and you were eating. I was kind of grinning to myself when I would listen because it seemed like couscous, peppers, you know, grilled peppers, and you were eating that pretty much every day of the week type of thing, and then gradually you started adding a few things in. But you know, my favorite is when I emailed you. You have to tell the story of when you decided to make your own hummus.
God. Yeah, I mean, early on, I didn't know how to prepare food. You know, I always was intimidated by it. So I found one meal that kind of clicked, and that was couscous, mushrooms, peppers, and onions. And I'd make it every day for lunch. And it was easy. I knew the exact calorie count. I knew, you know, I could dial it in. And I was eating hummus a lot. I really fell in love with hummus. And, you know, spending a lot of money on hummus. And hummus, from store-bought hummus, has a ton of oil in it and a ton of calories. And so I decided if I make my own hummus, I can control the oil, I can reduce the calories, and I can eat more hummus for fewer calories. So I got a recipe that said, you know, you get your chickpeas and you put them in a blender and you grind them up in the blender and you or your food processor, and then you add some spices here and some tahini there, and then guess what? You have a big batch of hummus. But And you know, and I, in my defense, nowhere in that recipe, and since I'm doing, you know, Whole Foods now, I'm going to get dry chickpea. And nowhere in that recipe did it say soak the beans first. And so I put dry chickpeas in a food processor, and for, I think, the better part of an hour, I processed dried chickpeas into what looked like sawdust. And I kept adding oil, and I kept adding spices, and I kept tasting it, and it tasted like the worst vile thing you've ever, like wood, I guess. And, you know, it's right now I think of, God, what an idiot, you know, we got to at least prepare the beans. But it's, yeah, it was just, I was so literal. It did not say in that recipe, soak those beans, you know. From then on, you know, I got canned and already pre-soaked beans. So, but yeah, it was like making sawdust hummus.
I loved it. I mean, I just had such a vivid picture of, you know, the dust flying in the kitchen. And I think you even said that your wife came by and just was thoroughly disgusted with the mess you were making and just basically ignored you. And, you know, it's like, go ahead, you know,
yeah,
die, buddy, die.
It was, well, you could, you know, after a while you could smell the little, you know, engine of the food processor. It was just starting to burn up because it was just grinding dry beans, and you could smell the burning of the machinery and the food processor. And then it just got to the point she was like, you know, I don't think you did that right.
it was certainly classic. It was classic. Absolutely classic.
I know.
You know, that's, know. If you ever write your memoirs, that's got to be in it. You know, somewhere you've got to get that in there, because it was just classic. And I also remember that, you know, you were talking to Megan, who lived in California and had vegan places, mm-hmm. every place, you know, around the block, and Whole Foods here. And you were going to Walmart to get your vegetables and, you know, making the pilgrimage to a Whole Foods, I don't know, another state away on the weekends. You know, and I think that's great dedication. I mean, even now I live in Port Charlotte, Florida, which is Southwest small, you know, basically, you know, mainly vacationing type Florida towns. And we, you know, we have, everybody has a Walmart, but anyway, so you would go to Walmart, you know, for most of your stuff, and maybe make the pilgrimage to Whole Foods on the weekend. And, you know, I mean, it again, it proves that you can do this way of nutrition, you know, in a lot of different varieties. And, you know, of course, now Walmart is making a pledge to get more organic things in. But still, the produce at Walmart will work for most people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that I think over the past 4 years, Walmart, it's the only place, there's two grocery stores in this town. Walmart has the best produce and the best variety of stuff. The other one is it's Winn-Dixie. It's, you know, it's a southern chain, but Winn-Dixie's around here are, you know, they're either great or they're not so great. So the produce at this one's not that great. And, but Walmart has, to their credit, been buying, you know, or offering more, organic, non-dairy, non-meat options of, you know, like you can find quinoa now, or you can get, you know, they've got more selection of dairy-free milk. And it's gotten easier to get here. And, you know, it's like the produce. Yeah. I mean, if you can find some, you know, like squash in the summer, you know, butternut squash in the winter, you know, your seasonal vegetables, they're always around. And I just, you know, when I'm in a bind, I still do a lot of times. I just chop some stuff up, throw in the pan, saute it in water, and I'm ready to go. I've gotten so much more flexible with preparing food now that it's, you know, it used to be recipe based. It used to be, I'd have to have special ingredients. Now, if I can have a couple of vegetables, some beans, a potato, I'm great, you know. So, but yeah, you can do it anywhere you live. It's easy. It just takes a little planning.
Sorry, I have two dogs that think that they're in charge of the neighborhood.
Yeah, I got one of those too.
But yeah, so yeah, I also... think that is a problem with, presents itself as a difficulty in the how-to. So people gravitate to plant-based vegan cookbooks that tend to be somewhat complicated, and it becomes stressful about what I'm going to do. Or you go buy, you know, 8 tons of vegetables, and they're all sitting on the table, and what do I do with them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, usually said earlier, back when I wasn't much of a cook, and I wasn't, and I really was bound to the cookbook because I didn't know what to do. And, you know, that's the biggest thing is once you get a hang of it, you just throw stuff in a pan. I mean, it's that easy, you know, and you want to get fancy, you can do a recipe, but if you're in a hurry or in a bind, I mean, like tonight, we're taking my son to see some friends play in a junior high football game. So I'm making a baked potato, some refried beans, a few onions. I got some sauteed vegetables from a couple of days ago. I'll throw those in the microwave and I've got a meal, you know, and that's 10 minutes prep. You know, you can do a lot with potatoes and beans and a couple of seasonal vegetables. And it's just that easy. You know, that's the myth of it, is it has to be fancy and there's a lot of rules. And it really, I mean, my mom is born in the South, lived in the South all her life, and she's never made anything without butter or a ton of oil. But since I've become vegan, she has learned and really learned how to modify her Southern based food. So that I could eat it. And she's altered her dressing recipe during Thanksgiving. Her vegetables, which usually would have had a stick of butter in them, now have water. And it's just that simple to take what you've always done and just take one small ingredient out that's not healthy and make it totally healthy and give a lot of options. And it's just, the more you think about it, the simpler it becomes.
Yes. I mean, I'm from West Virginia originally, and you know, my grandmother had a thing of lard on top of the stove that went into the pan before, you know, she ever started cooking anything. Mm-hmm. And my mom's Italian, and there was oil in the pan before she started cooking anything. And so, you know, my mother, has certainly altered her Italian recipes. So that was going to be my next question. When you started this, you were the single person in your household with two sons and a wife, and you were the plant-based guy, or you were making the changes, mm-hmm. and they were kind of sticking to their standard American diet. How has that evolved?
We're still there. There's some things that I can make that they'll all eat, but we're still sort of at that state. My youngest son loves vegan pizza that I make, which is, I got a recipe that's essentially Pillsbury pizza dough and ragu pizza sauce and some vegan cheese. It's that simple, and he loves it. From time to time, I'll make a huge pasta bake with vegetables and pasta, and my wife will make that, and I make salads for everybody, so my wife and I for lunch each day. So, you know, we're probably about where we were. We're still sort of not divided, but we're still living two different menus, if you will. But I will tell you this, my son, Preston, my oldest son, had a health course last year, and he had to watch Forks Over Knives, and he no longer eats beef. So he'll still eat chicken, but he won't eat beef anymore. Mm-hmm. So he kind of got scared out of beef.
Baby steps in some, you know, I think, you know, people, that's another, you know, obstacle for some people is the household that is divided. I think if you're the guy doing the cooking, that certainly helps that you can, you know, make your own. And, then, you know, you have help with the other person making what they want.
It's not always ideal, but it's what we have and what we do, and it's just the way we are. So it's, you know, it's a choice I've made, a choice they've made, and we make it work. Mm-hmm. So,
How about does your mom do any plant-based meals, or are they just, when you come over, they kind of cater to what, you know, they kind of watch for you?
Well, I think she still makes a lot of stuff for my dad, conventional. But she's realized that there are things that she, you know, dad doesn't miss when it's not in there. So if she gives him, you know, the green beans are a great example. She'd always put a huge, you know, bunch of pork into the green beans to season them. But she doesn't do that anymore because of dad's cholesterol. So, you know, he doesn't miss it. But I've also taught her that you don't always want to advertise, you know, because dad may want it back in there, but if he doesn't know the difference and he thinks it's good, then fine, he's going to be great, you know? So it's almost the same thing. If I give something that's plant-based that the boys don't know, that they think is not plant-based, they don't get, you know, quote unquote grossed out, or they don't automatically prejudge it. But yeah, mom's kind of learned that it, you know, like I remember there was a couple of Thanksgivings ago, she made a huge batch of green beans, and she was like, wow, these really taste good without the meat in them. I was like, well, there you go. It's supposed to, you know. So she's slowly but surely, and she's always battled with her weight all her life, and you know, I tried to tell her that, you know, the less butter and cheese you use, the easier it is to cut that weight. And so she's modified. I wouldn't say she's gone all the way over by any means, but she's modified a good deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's somewhat difficult to approach, you know, this is the ethnic way that, you know, someone has eaten all their lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's almost an attack on your heritage a little bit, or, you know, while it was good enough for you when you were growing up and I was in charge, but all of a sudden mm-hmm. now. So
it's hard. And that's probably the hardest part of it is making a lifestyle change that goes contrary to a cultural way of life or a cultural way of upbringing. And that was the hardest thing for my mom to get was she didn't understand that now I ate tons of food that I never would touch as a child and didn't want the stuff that I always demanded from her. And so, and especially in the South, and then I would also imagine, and I would guess an Italian community, it would probably any ethnic community, food from a mother is a way of expressing affection. And so for her to make the food that I've always eaten was her way of saying, I love you, and here I'm giving you what you want. And, you know, we had to have some talks where I was like, listen, I love you and I know you love me. Your food, the food that I no longer eat, you know, was killing me. And that doesn't mean that you were killing me, you know. So you can still make food for me, you know, excuse me. You can still make great food for me, but, you know, not what you used to make. And you can still show me affection that way. And so it was a hard adjustment for her, you know. We Southerners talk love with food a lot, and food is an emotional release, and it's also a way of showing affection. And so that was probably the hardest adjustment for mom, was to see me not want the things that she'd always shown me love with.
Yeah, that's it's very difficult. And I heard an interesting thing. I don't know if you. I think you all may have made reference to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. There's a physician there. Yeah. He's African American, and he gives lectures and talks about soul food. And I don't mm-hmm. know if you've ever heard him say this, like, well, where did soul food come from? And if you ask, you know, mm-hmm. people assume that it, you know, it's an African thing or West Indies thing. And it's like, no, it's slave food. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, you're holding on to something that really wasn't part of your heritage. You made it work and, you know, there's an emotional attachment to it, but it really, you know, your heritage was actually taken away from you as far as your, you know, your food heritage. And I thought that was extremely interesting.
Yeah, huge slaves were given rations of pork and corn and cornmeal. And so they made the best they could with those rations, and they needed that food because they were being worked to death in the field. And those food traditions, food ways, held on through freedom and through the rise of a free black community. And so, yeah, the soul food was essentially the remnants of, or the, you know, the heritage of slave food. And it was, you know, and the lifespan of a slave was very low, comparable to the age we grow to now. And so the typical things that would have been detected now, like heart disease or cancer, they may have been detected then, but that was essentially almost too late because they were going to die. They were dying younger then, they being worked to death. So yeah, it's one of the things where it's like, you know, once you realize the heritage of this food, then it's maybe easier to let it go.
Yeah, I you know, I find it all very interesting. It's, you know, it's not unlike, you know, the Italian heritage too, you know, in the Irish, you know, Italian heritage, they use pasta to stretch a meal for a poor family. And again, you know, it was feeding your family out of love, and, you know, you use the pasta to stretch the meal. And then now we've kind of, you know, taken it the American twist on things, and it's, you know, pasta, 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 and the Olive Garden and all the oil and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and just,
I know.
You know, and change. And the same thing with, you know, the Irish. As far as, you know, my grandmother would make dumplings and gravies and, mm-hmm. you know, these real heavy biscuits and, you know, these breads that, you know, with lard and all this, and pie crust with lard. You know, I tell my friends, it's like, I never, in my patients, I say, growing up, I didn't have a piece of fruit that wasn't in a pie. I mean, it was just how I grew up. You know, don't eat that. We can make a pie out of it. You know, that was.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where it's that food was so calorically dense because people were working with hands and feet on feet outside at hard labor, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And we're not now. So yeah. we don't need dumplings every night. We don't need fried foods every night. We don't need the things that, you know, people from our past ate regularly to have the energy to work all day, hard labor. You know, it's a lifestyle change. So we've got to eat for our sedentary lifestyle now, not pretending we're cutting down trees in the forest all day.
So before you had the episode where you got sick before going to Disney, you know, physicals, doctor, and he'd say, hey, Gordon, you know, you might want to skinny up, even give you any kind of a hint that way, or just kind of pat you on the back and say, you know, keep at it, professor, and we'll see you back in a year.
Well, that's funny because before then I never went to the doctor unless I was sick. I didn't do annual checkups. I didn't do, you know, I'd go to the, if I got, and I didn't get sick that much. Mainly it would be flu or cold or allergy. So I wasn't sickly, you know, unless, you know, and it, as a child, I had a ton of bronchitis, but my parents were smokers. And so the connection there, but I just never went to the doctor. And it was funny because a couple of years before they found the high blood pressure, my mom had one of those, you know, battery operated cuffs at her house because she had high blood pressure. And it was mainly because she essentially eats food with her salt, or used to. And so she put me on it, and it was high. And I dismissed it because it was a battery operated drugstore bought cuff. And I was like, you know, you're pressing me intense. This doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. And so it was high then, but I dismissed it because of the technology. And, so no, I never went to the doctor, so nobody could ever catch it. And it took essentially thinking I had the flu to get me in there. And I was active too. I mean, we went to a health club. I did spin class. I did step aerobics. I was reffing soccer games, for high school and travel soccer. So I was running a good bit in these games. So I was active, but I didn't eat, properly. And so my diet really just essentially, counteracted any physical fitness that I was gaining from that activity.
I remember when my daughter, when we first moved to Florida, and I put her in the, you know, local soccer clubs, and we would go to practice or go, and then Friday nights or whatever night the games were, and I would look around at all the people eating the fast food and the amount of overweight people. Do you think that part of you're not addressing things was that you look around and you kind of look like everybody else? So you were pretty much the norm, you know, you get in your 30s, you have 40s, you have kids, and everybody just spreads out, and that's just the normal way of being.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, the big joke or the big irony of all this is that when I was 263 pounds on a 5'8" frame, nobody said anything. But when I got down to 156 on a 5'8" frame, people thought I was too skinny. I was sickly. I needed to gain weight. So we've come to accept bigger as normal and healthy as abnormal. And so when I got to a healthy weight, when I was fit, people thought I was something was wrong with me and that I'd gone too far. And honestly, if you look at some of the weight charts that you're familiar with, I was in the high part of the ideal weight zone then, even at 156, you know, 142 was like the low end. So I was like the high end of the range of the healthy weight. And, people were telling me that I was sickly and I needed to put weight back on. And, you know, it's crazy, how topsy turvy it has become in our culture that I could be deathly obese and seen as normal.
Yeah. In medical school and in medicine, most drugs are calculated on the weight of a male being 70 kilograms. And, you know, we hardly see females at 70 kilograms anymore. You know, people are so much more heavy that, you know, you're always having to get out. It doesn't mean anything to know that standard dosage because nobody is that for the most part.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of it. I guess like any reformed person, when I finally said, this is how I want my practice to be. And I've always recommended diet and exercise to my patient. You need to lose weight. And I've been around as far as, you know, maybe Mediterranean diet, cut the fat out, cut the beef out, cut the pork out, decrease your portions. That was kind of the way I, you know, presented things. And then finally, when I said, you know, okay, this is it. Plant-based low oil. This is the way it's got to be. It was quite a shocker to people, you know, to try to get this across to them. And I was so discouraged when nobody really wanted to hear that. And, you know, I can't not go in the room and try it. And I usually tell people on the second visit or third visit, you know, I give it my college try. I give you the hour of everything I can do to educate you. And if I see a glimmer of hope, I'll keep at it and you can ask me anything you want. But then but once you don't, then, you know, I guess you're on your own and we'll just, you know, I'll take care of you and pick up the pieces.
There's only so much you, I mean, that was the thing. If it doesn't click, I mean, it's the same way with someone's career path or their education or the way they want to eat or live. If it doesn't click, it's not going to work. I mean, it took a while for me, even after I was running, for it to click that this is the way it's healthiest for me. And then once it clicked and once I bought into it, then it worked. But yeah, there's only so many times you can bang your head against a wall. And if it doesn't click, it's just not going to go. So, but you'd rather have them, you know, come back than to sort of not come back to you if you're going to keep going, you know, harping on it in a way. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So you do what you can, and you don't want to drive them away, but you also want to say, listen, I really strongly believe that you should follow this path. But yeah, if it doesn't click with them, it just finally had to click for me. And when it did, you know, it worked. But for a while, it didn't. I didn't want to hear any of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of physicians now that are talking more about, in course with the change in the healthcare system, you know, more of wellness-based healthcare as opposed to, you know, disease-based healthcare. But it comes down to how do you get the people in the door or the people that realize that, you know, hey, you know, you're not healthy. You know, it's not normal to have high blood pressure. It's not normal to have high cholesterol when you're in a society that, you know, if you look at the guy across the table from you or, you know, the next movie chair over or whatever, that everybody's on the medication. So it's really, you know, hard to get the word out that, you know, hey, this is not normal. And, you know, we could prevent some of this stuff. And I still don't know how to, you know, other than, you know, I do some, you know, community lectures and running events and things like that. And of course, and hopefully this podcast that will, you know, touch somebody and say, like, well, let's fix this before it's completely broken, because it's a lot easier to change things like you did than, you know, to get the two or three stents or the bypass or the stroke. And then you're really up a creek.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, looking back, for a while when I had that pill, the pill kept the pressure down so I could continue to live the way I'd always lived and eat the way I'd always eaten, you know, and it was almost like it was too convenient. That pill made it too convenient. But there was, you know, the point where it was like, you know, I'm slave to this pill. This pill rules my life. If I forget this pill, I panic. If I run out and didn't get my prescription filled, I panic. Am I going to blow up, you know, over 24 hours? It's almost the point where it's like, I like being free. I like being free from that, you know, now. And so it's weird because the pill is convenient. The pill is easy. The pill is there. It's always, you know, it's waiting for you. And you don't have to make any difficult choices. And sometimes I think that, you know, once we realize that that's just not a way to live our life, then it'll click, you know. But it's too easy, right, to just take that pill and live the way we've always lived and keep our fingers crossed that pill always works.
Exactly.
Because, I think over time it won't, especially if you just keep on eating that way.
No, it's like putting the sandbags out before the flood, you know. It'll hold the water back for a while, but then it's all eventually going to rush in.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that stuff's going to build up in the arteries, and you may not have a stroke, but then you're going to have a heart attack. So which one do you want? You know, so it's easy to look back, but I still remember the way I was, you know, when I was on the medication and living the way I just felt like I wanted to. But it's hard, but you know, you just keep talking about it, and I guess living by example is the only thing. The best thing we can do.
And which brings me, you know, you're a professor at a university in Alabama, and what's the demographic of your faculty? You know, are they more like the old Gordon or the new Gordon?
They are. Well, it's funny because I go back and forth. There's one professor on my department who's vegetarian. And she's extremely healthy. She's thin. She's not active physically, but they hike, and you know, it's not like an endurance lifestyle, but it's an active lifestyle. But she's vegetarian. And there have been some people on campus who have gone vegetarian, you know, and asked me questions about how to help and all, and I've done that. But by and large, it's you know, they're from all walks and all locations of the country, as most universities are, and they're still, you know, omnivore health. Lifestyle, I should say. And I have a couple we joke with, you know, that we go back. It's like, you know, like almost like a camaraderie, joking with one of mine. A friend has a Christmas party every December where the, you know, good bit of our department and the university community show up. And usually there's about 7 types of meat. So I just call it the Christmas meat party, you know, and he'll come back and he'll say, well, we're going to have some beans for you, you know. And so it's like I think everyone realizes that they respect what I am. There's no judging, if you will, but they respect what I am, but they've chosen to do what, you know, they're going to do. But every now and then I'll have somebody send me an email or call me from locally that they're going to try it. And I'm always like, listen, call me anytime, email me. I'll do everything I can to help you. It's easier than you think, you know? The first couple of years I didn't make a big deal out of it. I mean, people were wondering why I was losing so much weight, but now people know. You know, when I go to meetings on campus, they'll have an option for me, you know, salad without all the cheese, or a vegetable plate instead of a meat plate. So, you know, it's slowly, you know, I guess my reputation's growing of this is what I am and what I've done. And so I've got a little bit of credibility behind it because of what I've done. So, you know, if they haven't changed, they've thought about it, because everybody always kind of comes up with, well, you know, I still do this, but I also do this, and I've modified that. So I think that's good. And, you know, so I encourage them to make any modification that they can away from an unhealthy choice, you know, so.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you have seen the Joe the Juicer, Sick, Fat, and Nearly Dead. I was amazed with the first movie when he, you know, he went across the country, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, it's great that you're doing that, and it's great that you're losing weight, and, you know, too bad you were sick and you have to do this, even though they may have looked worse than he does, but I could never do that, you know. And
right.
You know, maybe if he had a mirror with him that they could see, you know, it's like, did you look in the mirror here, buddy? You need it just as bad as I do. But
yeah,
people just don't seem to, you know, you're the sick one, that you've declared yourself sick, so you need to get fixed, but I'm not sick yet, so I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm doing fine, or I could never give up my fill in the blank, or I've got to have my cheese, or, you know, so it's, you know, it's a choice. And the best, you know, I've found that I can do is just encourage and say, listen, if you ever want to make any changes, let me know. You know, I'm here. And, you know, but yeah, you know, you're right. There's always you had to, and it's easier if you're forced to. And, you know, I didn't have to. I could have stayed on the pill and stayed, you know, 210 pounds and kept running. But you know, it kind of, the success in weight loss and getting faster as a runner and all that stuff come together, it kind of, you know, just builds, right? The enthusiasm builds when you see a success, especially when your clothes start fitting better. It's, you know, it's like, wow, let's keep this going.
Absolutely. Well, you've done fantastic. So you went marathon to marathon to marathon, and you've done some triathlons, and it seems like you're more focusing on ultras now.
Yeah, you know, I for a while there, I was really trying to BQ to qualify for Boston, and I did 5 marathons in a 56 week period. I raced them. I just didn't run them. You know, I was trying to BQ on each one, and I, you know, got progressively faster. Then I started getting a little bit slower, and I realized that my brain was wasted, my body was wasted. So I said, I'm going to take some time off and do triathlon, you know. And so I did some triathlon. I did a half distance, half iron distance, and that was fine. But I was never been a fan of swimming. And after a marathon in 2012, I decided I was going to run some trails and do an ultra and get, you know, just sort of enjoy life on the trail and not stress about pace. And, you know, I got to the point where I really enjoyed being in the woods. And I've done a couple of marathons since then, but I've kind of let go of that push to try to get to Boston. Now the longer distance journey really appeals to me, and I've done several 50Ks, and I'm looking at a 50 miler in March, and I think a year from this coming November, I'm going to try a 100 miler and see what I find out about myself being on my feet for that long. You know, I've done the marathon. I know what to expect. I know how that hurts. I now want to sort of explore the dark side of the brain when you've been on your feet for 20 something hours, you know, and see where that takes me.
Yeah, I must admit I'm intrigued by it. I've done two Ironmans now, and I told friends that did that, it's like, oh, there's no way I could sit on a bike that long. And I just couldn't get my head around that. And, you know, now, since I started riding, I'd rather ride a bike for 5 hours than be in a car for 5 hours.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know, but I'm not sure, you know, the ultra is still, it still seems like, you know, I'm back to sleep deprivation and then, you know, on your feet. And I tend to, you know, have a little trouble with, you know, blisters here and there and black toe, you know, toenails here and there. And it's like, I'm just not sure my feet would put up with this, but it is intriguing. And I would guess that someday I'm going to pull the trigger on at least a 50K to get a shot.
Well, it's funny, you know, it's like if you've done the Ironman, you can do a 50K. I mean, it's just a long walk in the woods, you know.
Yeah, it's a long walk in the woods. All right. Now, how are you fueling? Are you doing gels and things like that? Or are you trying to do more natural things?
Well, there was a period where I was doing nothing but dates and peanuts, like on long bike rides. A friend of mine had told me about how if you shove a peanut in a big date, it's almost like a payday candy bar because it has the sweet and the salty. And I was doing that for long triathlon bike rides. And I tried that in a marathon, and I had these dates and had this old sticky bag, and I'm trying to run, you know, a sub-8 pace in a marathon and trying to get sticky dates out of the bag, out of my hand. You know, I was just like, this isn't going to work. So I went to gels and shot blocks, mainly Hammer or Cliff. They're both vegan. And but now for ultras, I would take, like, I'll have a gel for emergencies, but what I try to do now is I got some sample of a product that's new to me called Tailwind. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's got salt in it. It's got the carbohydrates, but it's all liquid based. So you can sip on it. And the idea of sipping on it little by little throughout the hour, as opposed to just shoving a gel down my throat once every 45 minutes, has been working for me better. It seems to be more efficient for me. So I've done I did a stage race a couple of weekends ago, which was 53 miles over 3 days. He did like 16, 15, 16, and 22 or whatever, 21 or whatever that adds up to 53. And so I did Tailwind in a flask, and then I had water in my pack, and then whatever was at the table, the aid station that was vegan, generally potato chips here and there. They had some nuts, they had fruit, peanut butter jelly. I'd supplement with that, and that really worked well for long days. You know, if I was doing a marathon now, you know, if I was going to do a marathon, I'd do gels probably. They're quick, they're easy, and I'd supplement that with Tailwind and a water bottle. But I found that if I get smaller bits of calories throughout the hour instead of one big gush of a gel, I do better because I tend to go too far before getting another gel, you know, and that's the problem with still trying to maintain weight, but also train, is that I often sometimes neglect my nutrition on training runs too much. You know, I want to have a calorie deficit at the end of the day instead of being even. So I'll skip a gel. And sometimes in races, I tend to fall back into that mentality, and I should eat more. And so during the stage race, I ate more than I felt like I needed to, and even though I was tired by the end of the 3 days, I never balked. I never fell to the bottom. And so I think I've kind of dialed it in now. So it's a supplement between, you know, some natural stuff, some man-made stuff, just depending on the situation.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, I've been, you know, sort of playing around with that as well, because I felt like on the bike on my last Ironman that I kind of was diligent about taking in enough calories on the bike that I wouldn't bonk, but then it kind of sort of caught up with me on the run, and I felt like maybe I had too many calories and I got kind of slushy. And, you know, that kind of slowed me down. And it's like, okay, so my next, you know, go back to the drawing board. It's like, I want to kind of work on my fat burning efficiency, so to speak, you know, and, maybe run more without, gels, or push that time period, you know, that long, slow stuff, and then some tempo stuff. Have you noticed that, you know, with these really long, increasing your mileage so much for the ultras, have you noticed that you actually are becoming a better fat burner?
I don't know how to tell the difference, really. I mean, I don't know if it's because I'll do, you know, my easy stuff during the week. I won't eat before I run. I'll have a half a cup of black coffee, drink a little water, and then I'm out the door. And those runs are, you know, generally an hour to 90 minutes. If I do tempo, or if I do a speed work, or if I'm going to do a long work with hills or something like that, I'll eat, you know, half a banana, you know, just get stuff going. So, you know, I think, and I've been doing this for a couple of years, sort of fasted runs. And so maybe I am a little better at burning fat and just sipping and making small, you know, small doses of the food in small increments during a race. Because I don't think I ever eat as much as some people eat during some of these races. I mean, generally it's a couple of potato chips and a half a banana or a quarter banana at an aid station. And I don't sit there and just pig out, but you know, and I don't feel like I'm bonking or anything. So maybe I am. It's just hard for me to know the difference or tell. I mean, I do know that there are sometimes during like a long run, or if I'm doing a tempo and I like just, you know, throw a half a gel down, I know that at that moment it's like getting a little turbo kick. You know, I can really feel it, especially in a long run. So maybe I am, you know, better at it, you know. And I think over time, because I've been really running seriously for what, 4 or 5 years now, that the body adapts to the running, and so the caloric needs are a little bit less unless you're really intense, you know, and the body's more efficient at sort of fueling, I guess. And so maybe I, you know, it's hard to tell. I really don't know the difference, but I know that I probably eat a little less than most people do, and maybe I could eat more. You know, maybe I should. I'm going to pace a friend in a couple of weeks at a 100-mile race locally. I'm going to do probably 30 miles with her, and so I'm probably going to need to be higher, you know, emotionally and fueled than I usually am, because I'm helping her. So I'll see if it works.
Yeah, it's not a good idea to bonk when you're the pacer.
No, and it's the overnight hours. I think pick her up at 8 o'clock and go to like 2 a.m. So I've really got to be on top of my game.
You're the cheerleader, so yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing about the longer stuff, like especially 100 or 50 and 100, is that you can't just go on or get, you know, man-made stuff the whole time. You got to have real stuff in you. You can't, you know, it's like an Ironman. You can't just do 28 gels for an Ironman. You got to have a little something to chew on, right? I mean, you got to have something that feels like it's real, you know, even if it's a piece of banana. And I know that at a lot of these hundreds, I did an aid station a few weeks back, or last March, I should say. And, you know, there's a point after 50 miles where you've got to have real food. Your body is just going to rebel if it doesn't have real food, you know. And so there's a point, you know, especially if you've been on your feet, you know, 16, 20 hours, you can't just go on, you know, chemicals alone. And so that's part of the allure here, is that it's a total unknown. You know, what's ever going to require nutrition, mind, emotion, you know, the senses, I mean, all this stuff. It's kind of exciting. It's also scary, you know, because it is unknown. So.
Yeah, I love the science experiment of it all. And, you know, even when it's not working, I can't wait to try something else again. But yeah, I have the same thing with the gel. I pulled one out you know, 3 or 4 miles into the run, and I looked at it and put it back in my pocket. I just couldn't, I couldn't even tear the tab off of it. You know, it's like, oh no, no way. You know?
Yeah. I mean, you just, your stomach's got to have something to work on other than those, than that gel, especially if you've been doing it all day.
Yeah.
That's the trick, right?
Well, good. Well, I certainly do. It's been, again, a pleasure to actually finally get to speak with you. And, you know, I do thank you again for all you've done for anybody that's listened out there, and me especially. And, you know, I can't wait to share this with, you know, my friends and, you know, some patients. And because I think you're the, you know, it's the real deal. You're the guy that, you know, decided to change, and you did, and this is what you can do. And it's even better that it's not just like, you know, one marathon and done. You know, you maintained this over years. It's become a lifestyle for you. So it's not like, you know, the Biggest Loser and, you know, okay, you've gained the weight back and, you know, you're back on the couch again. So, you know, I admire you and wish you all the best luck. And I hope you keep that blog up so I can keep following you.
I will. I've gotten lazy. I'm trying to finish up a book manuscript. Actually, I've sent it off 2 weeks ago, but I'm just trying to get back to the blog now. I got so late. I had to let something go while I was finishing up the book. And it's now I got to get back to it. But yeah, I'm just trying to stay alive and finally become the body that I've always wanted to become. So it's, you know, if it helps other people, that's the added benefit. And I'm honored that you think that.
Well, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, I look forward to maybe checking in with you again once you've done that 100-miler.
Oh yeah, for sure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Gordon. Nice to meet you.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Right. Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Gordon. I certainly do wish him well on all of his future endeavors. You know, he's a great representation of what can be done with change in diet and exercise. I also think it's pretty neat that you can listen to a podcast and follow somebody along as their life changes or whatever they tend to document and kind of become a friend and a fan of them. And I think he was probably somewhat surprised at what he could do and the influence that he didn't realize that he would have on other people and certainly even my practice. You know, he was just trying to help himself gain his health back so he can be around for his family. I guess I have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I really did become a physician to help people, and I take it quite personal when there are comments made in the media and by various people that stereotype that MDs are bad because they don't do prevention. And I've thought a lot about it recently, and in somewhat of defense of my position, I have to say that it does take a long time to become a physician and learn the pathology of disease, and we're taught to take care of sick people, and we're taught to try to help them in the time of crisis. It's like the floodgates have already opened, or the floodgates of illness are there, and we're trying to keep people from dying that are already sick, let alone looking for those people before they become sick. I think medicine is evolving, and it's time that we can look at things like hypertension and diabetes as markers to prevent the subsequent complications such as stroke, heart attack, and cancer. And I think we can turn our attention to that a little bit more. I do believe that most physicians are very compassionate individuals and are dedicated to reducing suffering in the best way that they can see. And they only want the best for their patients. Anyway, enough of my soapbox for this evening. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and I hope that you're inspired to try some changes in your nutrition that can improve your health. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. I can be reached at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. Until next time, I wish you much happiness and health. Thank you for listening.